The next case on the calendar is State versus Terry Lynn Neitzel. It's A19-0180, and once counsel are settled and comfortable, Mr. Donovan, put down his bag, open his books, pour water.
You know what I'm gonna say.
I know you both are familiar with the rules of the Minnesota Court of Appeals, but welcome this morning, and you'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes to rebuttal, and please state your name at the beginning of your argument. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Terry Neitzel. Mr. Neitzel was charged with and convicted of threats of violence and fifth-degree assault for swinging a shovel handle at his neighbor while he told her that he was going to kill her. I raised three issues in my brief. My argument today is going to focus on the first two issues. First, whether the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law to convict Mr. Neitzel of threats of violence, where he did not threaten to commit a future crime, but was describing the current crime. And secondly, whether the district court erred in failing to acknowledge Mr. Neitzel's request to discharge his counsel on the morning of trial. Now, we would ask that the threats of violence conviction be reversed and that the remaining count be remanded for a new trial. Section 609.713 provides that whoever threatens directly or indirectly to commit any crime of violence with the purpose to terrorize another or in reckless disregard of the risk of causing such terror is guilty of a crime. Now, at this point, we're not going to dispute that the threat to kill someone is a crime of violence. What we're looking at, though, is if this was a future crime of violence. We know from previous cases from the Supreme Court that a threat is a declaration of intent to injure someone, and that meaning of the threats of violence statute was furthered in Murphy, where the Supreme Court said that the statute mandates that it must be a threat to commit a future crime of violence. It is that future crime of violence and the underlying act that the statute is designed to deter and punish.
Mr. Donovan, I think respondent counsel in the brief suggested this, that the Murphy case did not change the law, and in fact, if I look at the facts of the Murphy case, it was really focusing on the nonverbal conduct meeting the statute. And I do see the quote you're referring to where the word future is put in italics, but did that case, by virtue of that, change anything from what the statute said up to that point versus what it says today?
It did, with that future language. There were sort of two parts of the, at that time, terroristic threats statute that they were looking at in Murphy. One was he was saying, I didn't say anything. I did stuff, and that's not a threat. And that is where they said, no, your act can also be a threat. The second part was he was saying, I was just harassing you. And they're saying, no, that is a threat that you are going to do something in the future. You are capable of coming back and committing those crimes that were suggested by the many terrible things that the defendant did in that case. And I think when the Supreme Court says that the statute mandates that it is to punish future crimes, it's not limited to its facts. That is the court even saying our interpretation of the statute later in that same paragraph. This is how they are interpreting it.
But so, then in Smith, you have the Supreme Court saying that we've never defined a specific amount of time for what we mean in the future.
And I think Smith actually was this court, but there was no appreciable amount of time, but they didn't shy away from the fact that, well, it's in the future, we don't know. I think maybe what the argument they were going with in Smith, which frankly I'm not entirely sure why they didn't just charge that as second degree assault, but what they were looking at was, you know, there was some time. This was throughout an interaction, and I think the key part of Smith is that knife waving that was the threat is sort of the final thing. I think if we change the facts in this case, we can get more in a sort of Smith mode. I think that if Mr. Neitzel says, I'm going to kill you, and then at some point later he swings the shovel, it's a little bit more of an uphill battle for me to say, you know, that's a future crime. I think the state's saying, well, you were going to do it in a few minutes. I think if we do the reverse as well, I think if he swings that shovel handle and hits the door jamb, and then as she's running away, at that point he says, I'm going to kill you, I think that would maybe be more suggesting that he's going to do something in the future. But when these actions are happening concurrently, which is what we have in this case, that's the state's whole theory that they argue in closing, that he said he was going to kill her while he is swinging a shovel handle, he is saying what he is doing in the moment. This is really sort of in a way about the conflict between the fifth degree assault statute and the threats of violence statute. With the assault, he has to intend for her to fear immediate bodily harm or death. And with threats of violence, he has to intend for her, or reckless disregard, that she is going to fear that he is going to do this in the future. You want someone to walk away from that encounter thinking you're going to do that later on. And an assault is, you want them to think you're going to do it now. And when you're swinging a shovel handle saying, I'm going to kill you, what you want that victim to feel is, I'm going to kill you right now. This is what is happening now. This is what that swing of the shovel handle means. That is how it's separate from Smith. In Smith, again, it was the final knife wave. I think, actually, the knife gets kicked out of the hand heroically, and then there's another knife that he's waving. And then the interaction is sort of done, and he leaves. So the threat that we can look at in that case is, you didn't give me the money. This is what's going to happen in the future. But when these acts happen concurrently, which is something we haven't really seen before, which is why neither of us are citing cases that are particularly on point, when that threat happens concurrently with that act, that is an assault. And that's what happened here. I'm not arguing that Mr. Neitzel didn't commit a crime. He certainly committed fifth-degree assault with the facts of this case. But that can't be transformed into a felony, terroristic threats, when he is not threatening her with any crime of violence in the future.
But if he says he's going to effing kill her,
mm-hmm.
You're saying that's right now I'm going to kill you?
Yes. I think something that we learn from these other threats of violence cases is that context is important. And the phrase, I'm going to blank, is certainly a phrase that is context dependent. If we are all sitting in my living room and I say, I'm going to go to the kitchen, and I continue sitting and we chat, and then after a moment, I get up, go to the kitchen, my initial statement of I'm going to go to the kitchen is me describing something I'm going to do in the future. If we're all sitting in my living room on the couch and I stand up and start walking and say, I'm going to the kitchen, I'm not saying I'm going to the kitchen in the future. I'm describing what I'm doing in the present. I'm currently going to the kitchen. So when that statement of I'm going to kill you happens concurrently with that act of swinging the shovel, that is a fifth degree assault, but that is not a threat of violence. So just to briefly touch on the second issue, on the morning of trial, Mr. Neitzel's counsel informed the district court that Mr. Neitzel wanted him to file a number of motions about venue and joinder that he was not going to file. And he also informed the district court that Mr. Neitzel did not want him to be his attorney anymore. At that point, the district court turned it over to Mr. Neitzel. Mr. Neitzel described the reason for some of these motions that he wanted made, and then ended by saying, if he's not going to do the paperwork, then I don't need him. I don't need him on me. He leaves. My rights have been violated. Now, this seems to be an unequivocal request to discharge his counsel. But rather than make any sort of ruling or determination on that request, the district court merely stated that there's no legal basis to move the trial and that it was going to proceed. And this was
so, error. Counsel, looking at our case law, that does require an unequivocal request, I think, to discharge. Which case would you compare the facts of this case to guide us to your conclusion, which is that this was an unequivocal request to discharge?
This is sort of another tough spot where I don't have a case quite on point.
Yeah, I was having a hard time
finding. And in preparing for this argument, I've sort of been of two minds on, am I going big here? Am I saying you need to declare a new rule that if someone says I want to discharge my attorney, you need to respond to that? I mean, it's essentially a motion that needs to be ruled on. And then I sort of thought, I don't know if I need to stand up here and say you should publish an opinion on this, because it just never seems to happen. In every case, I mean, essentially, if he wanted to discharge his attorney, he would have had three routes he could have requested to go. He could have requested to represent himself. He could have requested to hire his own attorney and maybe ask for a continuance. He could have asked for substitute counsel from the public defender's office. And all of those have different ways that the district court is going to rule on them. They all require a different analysis for this court to then examine it. But when this district court doesn't say anything, it becomes very difficult for this court to analyze anything.
Well, part of that's hard in this case also is that he had been probably, you could characterize them as a difficult client for the public defender's office during the course of their representation of him.
Sure. I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school when I say they maybe didn't get along.
They didn't get along with the first one, so then the main PD steps in, and there was just a long history there.
And in fairness to Mr. Neitzel, I don't think that the main PD really liked him either. Twice before he was ever actually his attorney, he goes into district court and is telling the district court, I don't think he's eligible. He's not even his attorney at that point. And then goes again and says, I know you just had him up on the stand and under oath and swearing about his income. I still don't think he's eligible. I think that both sides didn't really care much for one another. But what's difficult here is all these cases, when you're saying, is there a case that helps you? Every case, be it for substitute counsel, be it for, you know, I want a continuance to hire my own, or be it a request to, you know, just represent myself, there's always dialogue. The court is always asking follow-up questions, even briefly. You know, we need a clear and unequivocal and timely request to discharge counsel. Even in, I think, the unpublished case the state cites, and in Bloom, when they were saying, well, this was kind of equivocal, you know, we sort of went back and forth. It's equivocal because there's a dialogue about, do you want to do this? Is this something you want to do? And it then gives this court something to review to determine whether or not the district court's decision was error. And so when I said I don't know if I want to go big and say publish a case, I've literally just never seen this before. I think you were all district court judges. I can't imagine, also in your time reviewing appellate cases, that you've seen someone clearly state, again, I'm not sure entirely what the request is, but the request is definitely to get rid of his current attorney.
But except that during, once again, the course of the proceedings, he applied for a public defender more than once.
Sure. And he may have been wanting to represent himself. He may have wanted to, can I get another public defender because this guy also doesn't like me? Because again, he's coming to court twice, not as my attorney, questioning if we can represent him. Maybe that money that everyone seemed to think he had but he didn't have came in and he said, oh, I've got someone I want to hire. I'm sure that the PD would have wanted to step out at that point. Maybe would have needed continuance. But when the district court does nothing, when it doesn't comment on that response at all, we're sort of left in a position of trying to guess. And what I'm asking is, when someone makes a clear request to at least discharge their attorney, the district court can't ignore it. It can't just act like that statement was not made. Because again, it wasn't just Mr. Neitzel who put the district court on notice that he wanted to discharge the attorney. His attorney told the district court, he doesn't want me as his attorney. I'm going to let him make the record of that. So the court knew what Mr. Neitzel was requesting. He was at least asking that he didn't have his current attorney. But then it needed to make some sort of ruling on that one way or another. If the court had done, you know, not much, but a few statements, so we kind of have an idea of where it was going, I don't know that I raised this issue. But when it doesn't do anything, I think that's error, and I think that that would entitle Mr. Neitzel to a new trial. So if the panel has no further questions at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Everson. I represent the respondent in this case, the state of Minnesota. This case involves a defendant who opened the door to his apartment, swung a stick, hit the door frame, and said, I'm going to effing kill you. That is a terroristic threat, a threat of violence under Minnesota statute 609.731. And for that reason, and all the other reasons that I will discuss in a moment, the state would ask this court to affirm. I'd like to start with the language of the statute, which is, again, whoever threatens directly or indirectly to commit any crime of violence with the purpose to terrorize another. Okay. Appellant swung a stick, hit the doorframe, and said he was going to kill the victim. And the exact quote is, I'm going to F and kill you. That's page 38 of the transcript. That's a threat of terror. Now, with respect to appellant's argument that it needs to be a threat to commit some act in the future, I think that question has been answered by this court in Smith. And this court in Smith was considering an identical argument to the one that was made here. Here, the argument is that he threatened to commit an immediate crime. That's the same argument that the appellant was making in Smith. And this court in Smith said, while the Minnesota Supreme Court in Murphy talked about the threats of violence statute prohibiting future threats of violence, it has never defined a specific amount of time that must pass. And it said, here, appellant's threat to assault the victim is not changed by the fact that the threat was made during an ongoing confrontation. And that's essentially the facts here. And I want to be clear as to what the state's theory was in this case. The state's theory was not that Mr. Netzel was trying to kill the victim when he opened the door and swung the stick. The state's theory was that he was threatening to commit the crime of murder. That was a threat of violence. And I would point to the prosecutor's closing argument, beginning on page 69 on to page 70, where he said he was going to kill her, and he was yelling this at the same time that he was swinging a large stick in her direction, so she was scared. And then the prosecutor says, and I quote, he was trying, obviously, to threaten her. So the evidence shows that he did intend to terrorize her. And again, appellant was not charged with attempted murder. There's no allegation or evidence that he was trying to kill her here. So this is not, as appellant characterizes it, an example of him describing what he's doing while he's doing this. This was a threat to kill.
Do you believe, Mr. Everson, assault with a deadly weapon would have been appropriate or could have been charged in the same scenario?
Assault with a deadly weapon, it would depend on the nature of the stick. The record's not real clear as to exactly what this stick looked like or how thick it was, but that, I'm sorry, go.
Okay, and I obviously wasn't charged, but I was just responding to your last statement. The point being is, would you agree at least, though we don't have a definition of a temporal requirement by the Murphy case and not inconsistent with Smith, there will be a factual scenario, and you're arguing that this is not the factual scenario,
right,
that I'm going to assault you, I'm going to, and it happens all at the same time, that a terroristic threats would not be appropriate because it's happening all at the same time, but a person happens to verbalize it?
I would say if it is happening absolutely contemporaneous with the act, so there's no delay, not even a nanosecond, then that might call into question whether the terroristic threat statute applies. And that's, of course, not this case. And in my brief, when I talk about it, it does not need to be a future crime. What I was referring to is it does not need to be a crime that occurs sometime in the distant future. It can be a crime that occurs that is threatened to occur at the moment in which the act is taking place. And that's what we have here. We have him threatening to kill her, and he's sort of amping up the threat by taking the stick and hitting the stick against the doorframe. That was the state's theory at trial, and the jury obviously agreed with that theory because the jury found appellant guilty. And for that reason, we would ask this court to affirm, but I would also note that it would seem to present a somewhat absurd result if a mere statement that I'm going to kill you is a terroristic threat, but that statement accompanied with a physical act where you hit a stick against the wall would only be a misdemeanor assault fear. Because what we have here when he hits the stick against the door frame is he's, in a sense, upping the ante of the threat that's being made. And the threat obviously worked because the victim in this case, J.A., she was extremely fearful when this happened and she ran from the scene. So it's the state's position here that these facts and this evidence meet the definition of a threat of terror under the statute. And so we would ask the court to affirm the jury's verdict. I'd like to also address the second issue raised by appellant, which he had also discussed during his argument. This relates to the alleged request to discharge counsel. If you look at the exchange that gave rise to this issue, and it's on transcripts pages 3 and 4, not once does appellant say, I want to represent myself. And the Richards case, the Minnesota Supreme Court, says that this inquiry, or this sort of the what's often called a FARETA, after the United States Supreme Court inquiry, does not happen unless a criminal defendant asked to represent himself in an unequivocal manner. And when you look at pages 3 and 4, he never asks to represent himself. What he is doing, and this is consistent with what he has done throughout this case, is he is expressing frustration with what is now the second public defender that is handling his case. And we have a district court judge who has been here for this entire proceeding, I believe was the judge for all of the pretrial proceedings, and there were 3 or 4 where this issue came up. So the judge knows this defendant. The judge understands this defendant, understands that he is prone to complain about his attorney for, I think, reasons that most of us would consider to be an unwillingness to bring unsupported or frivolous motions. And the district court judge handled it appropriately because there has been no unequivocal request to represent himself, and there has been no showing of exceptional circumstances, which is the standard for appointing a new public defender if you're complaining about the services that you're receiving.
So what's your response to appellant counsel's argument that in this case it's not clear what our defendant was being unequivocal about, but he was being unequivocal in saying that the attorney had to leave? That's the language, I think, that's relied upon. And so the leave might have been to represent myself, or it might have been he's got to leave because I want substitute counsel. Sure.
So the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Richard case states that the request, you have not made a request to represent yourself until you unequivocally indicate that you want to represent yourself. And I cite a couple of federal circuit cases in my brief. And those cases talk about how we don't want the district court to sort of be introducing the idea of a defendant representing himself unless that defendant has first expressed a desire to represent himself in an unequivocal manner. And that's why the Supreme Court in the Richards case talks about, we first need an unequivocal request before we launch into a hearing to determine whether it's knowing, whether it's voluntary, so on and so forth. So the state's response would be that there is no authority for the proposition that absent an unequivocal request from a defendant to represent himself, that a district court judge needs to or should launch into that sort of inquiry. And we know from the record in this case that this defendant is very capable of expressing what he wants. I mean, he has done it multiple times in multiple pretrial appearances. He received an explanation from the district court in the March 27th, 2018 pretrial hearing about what his options were if he wanted to discharge his attorney. An appellant has consistently, both at the July 8th, the February 27th, and the March 27th hearing, expressed a desire to have public defender representation. So based on all of those facts, there's simply been no showing here that the district court was under an obligation to launch into the sort of inquiry that appellant is suggesting that the district court launch into in this case. So unless there are any further questions from the panel, the state would waive the remainder of its time and ask that this court affirm appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Mr. Donovan.
Thank you. Just briefly, touching on the second issue first. As far as the record goes, this was not the same judge throughout this. The first judge and the trial judge, when he discharged his public defender the first time, was the same judge as the trial judge. Then when he reapplied, I believe that's the March 27th hearing, that was Judge Flanagan. And then there's another March 29th hearing, I think, is when he finally gets a new PD again, and there's more discussion about his options. That's Judge Flanagan again. But Judge Wynn sort of bookends this. So it's not necessarily the same judge who knows, oh, I've explained all this to you before. Judge Flanagan is the one who really went into depth with him. And as far as just those circuit cases go, again, I think the Reese v. Nix case that was in the state's brief, when you look at that, when they're talking about is it equivocal, it's two full reporter pages of dialogue between the district court and the defendant, which is the exact opposite of what happened here. Just briefly about the threats of violence, I don't think that this is identical to Smith. I think this is the case that you posited, that this is concurrent. This is happening at the same time. I think a nanosecond even, as the state said, too short. I think we need a little bit more. But here, it's pretty clear the state's theory, this is happening at the same time. And that the jury may have found him guilty, the jury's not instructed about future crimes. The jury's not told that. That comes from Murphy, but that's not in the jig. So the jury wasn't asked to decide if he was threatening a future crime or a current crime. And just finally, I understand Mr. Neitzel wasn't charged with attempted murder, but what he was charged with was causing this victim to fear immediate bodily harm or death. What better way to show his intent to cause her immediate bodily harm or death than saying, I'm going to kill you as you're committing that act? So unless the panel has any further questions, we would ask that you reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next case is Timothy Wodark versus La